I feel rather like I should just sit down while I'm ahead. Thank you very much, Greg, for that lovely introduction. And thank all of you for inviting me to Lancaster to speak during your LGBT Week activities. This morning, I'm going to look at a topic of intense controversy in many churches, the Bible and homosexuality. But I'm going to look at this issue from a rather different direction than it's usually approached, that of the cultural construction of gender and sexual relations in ancient Mediterranean antiquity. I should say at the outset that this current controversy, I believe, the Bible functions far more as a justification for beliefs than as the cause of them. But even so, its prominence makes discussion of it important. Underlying the different perspective that I'm going to use this morning to talk about the Bible and homosexuality are two foundational assumptions. And you need to understand these first in order to sort of know where I'm going to go with this discussion. The first assumption is that the writings of the Bible, whether we're talking about the Hebrew Bible or the Christian Bible, with both Hebrew and Greek parts, the writings of the Bible are intimately connected to the ancient cultural systems in which they were produced. And second, that sexual roles are historical and cultural creations differently understood and differently formed across history. These two foundational assumptions, which, to be fair, are not without controversy in some, especially fundamentalist or evangelical Christian circles, are fairly well accepted by most classical scholars and biblical historians. What they suggest for the particular topic of the Bible and homosexuality is that to understand the Bible's view of same-sex erotic relations, one must understand the cultural construction of sexual relations generally, which were operative in the world in which the biblical writings were produced. It is that ancient Mediterranean world which provides the context needed to explicate the meaning of the Bible statements. Consequently, most of my discussion this morning will concern how sexual relations and gender roles were understood in the ancient Mediterranean cultures which produced the Bible. Before, however, I move into the main body of this talk, I want to pose two caveats, two warnings to you concerning the general topic of the Bible and homosexuality. The first caveat, which is probably one I don't need to make, but I will anyway, is that the Bible itself has precious little to say about same-sex eroticism, though one certainly might not guess that from the current level of national debate over its content. In the most generous estimate, there are only perhaps 12 verses in the entire Hebrew Bible and Greek New Testament put together that could be construed as having direct comment on same-sex erotic behavior. And that most generous estimate includes quite a few verses which contemporary biblical scholarship has argued fairly thoroughly to be irrelevant to the discussion. Indeed, the only uncontested verses that seem to be incontrovertibly linked to same-sex erotic behavior in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament turn out only to be four. Two separate one-verse prohibitions in Leviticus and one two-verse statement by Paul in the first chapter of his letter to the Romans. It is upon this tiny textual base that all of the direct arguments about the biblical understanding of same-sex erotic relations must be based. Given the numerous references to the Bible's view of homosexuality, or I have to do what the Bible tells me to do, or the Bible is my source of understanding about homosexuality, that are found in both ecclesiastical and secular writings, one can easily be misled into thinking that this was a topic of great importance for biblical writers. It was not. So my first warning, my first caveat, is that same-sex erotic relations are noteworthy in the biblical text primarily by their absence from discussion. The second caveat I wish to raise has to do with the word homosexuality itself. The word homosexuality is a modern term. It was coined in the 1880s in Germany, and it was first used in 1892 in this country. The term grew up and was popularized by a group of researchers who were studying and classifying sexual behaviors at the turn of the last century. People such as Richard von Krafft-Ebing or Havelock Ellis and others developed the study of sexuality into a medical subspecialty that was called sexology. It's not exactly the most lovely name, but sexology was what it was called. Prior to the work of the sexologists, it's not what I'd like on my business card, but it's... or maybe it is. Anyway, prior to the work of the sexologists, same-sex erotic acts were certainly well known. But by and large, just like cross-sex eroticism, they were believed to be acts anyone might perform. Out of the classificatory work of the sexologists of the late 19th and early 20th centuries came the proposal for a different species of person, the homosexual. No longer were individual same-sex acts seen as possible behavior for everyone. Instead, now same-sex acts were defined a special kind of person, the homosexual. This new kind of person was identified and defined by sexual object choice alone, a same-sex object choice. Consequently, homosexuality denotes a very modern way of looking at the construction of human identity as characterized primarily by what we call gendered sexual desire. That is, sexual desire has to be directed toward only one gender. With this concept of homosexuality, the idea of sexual orientation was born. And predictably, not long after the discovery of the homosexual orientation, modern sexologists defined the existence of a more dominant heterosexual orientation. Consequently, beginning in the late 19th and early 20th century, same-sex erotic acts were no longer the territory of all people, but now the domain of only those of a particular orientation. Besides its contemporary origins, the term homosexuality combines in itself contradictory elements. Not only is it a merger of a Greek root and a Latin root, that's a terrible thing to do, but more seriously, it combines fundamentally contradictory meanings in use today. On the one hand, when some people use the term homosexuality, they seem to mean a kind of predisposition toward sexual intimacy with people of the same gender that is present at least potentially in the sexual makeup of everyone, what we might call the pre-sexology view. In other words, the term homosexuality continues to bear a universal application. Because all people have the ability to be homosexual, for example, homosexuals can be portrayed as potential seducers of children and other adults into this same manner of erotic life. And thus, for some, all information about homosexuality should be silenced for fear of attracting new adherents to it. On the other hand, the word homosexual is also used today to refer only to a certain small percentage of the population who display a particular orientation. So in addition to the continuing universal meaning associated with the term, there's also a minoritizing meaning related directly to the arguments of the sexologists. In this perspective, only a certain group of people who live life in a certain way are understood to be homosexual. This minoritizing view understands homosexuality to be at its core an unchangeable sexual identity, probably developed during early childhood from genetic predispositions, which only a small percentage of the population embodies in any generation. Under this meaning of the term, people who are not homosexual in orientation cannot possibly be seduced into that identity simply by knowing about it or knowing someone who is homosexual. The minoritizing and the universalizing meanings of homosexuality, that is, either something only a few people are or something everybody can be, though deeply incommensurate meanings, often appear together in contemporary usages of the word. This definitional incoherence makes discussions of homosexuality particularly frustrating and confusing. For these reasons, the modern origins of the term and its internal incoherences, in talking about the Bible or the biblical world, the word homosexuality is both anachronistic and unhelpful, to say the least. Consequently, in my discussion of same-sex relations in the ancient world and of those texts within the Bible which have been used to talk about modern homosexuality, I will try to avoid using that term and use instead the more general term homoeroticism, because I do not want to assume at the outset that the construction of same-sex eroticism in the ancient Mediterranean world bears any resemblance to the construction of same-sex eroticism in the Western world of the 20th and 21st centuries. Okay, with these two rather long caveats in mind, let's turn now to the real talk, the discussion of sexuality in the ancient world. The single most important concept that defines sexuality in the ancient Mediterranean world, whether we're talking about the kingdoms of Egypt or Assyria, or whether we're talking about the later kingdoms of Greece and Rome, the single most important concept is that morally approved sexual acts never occurred between social equals. Morally approved sexual acts never occurred between social equals. Sexual acts, by definition, in ancient Mediterranean societies required the combination of dominance and submission. This crucial social and political root metaphor of dominance and submission as the definition of sexuality rested upon a physical basis that assumed every sex act required a penetrator and someone who was penetrated. Needless to say, this definition of sexuality was entirely male. Not surprising in the heavily patriarchal societies of the ancient Mediterranean. Nevertheless, this assumption that the difference in status between the dominant penetrator and the submissive penetratee was essential to all sexual behavior is prevalent in most sources from at least the Egyptian empires of the second millennium BCE all the way through the late Roman Empire and beyond. Of course, we must recognize that the vast majority of the laws and other texts from antiquity that give us some insight into sexual roles were written by men of elite or aristocratic classes. Whether or not the convention of dominance and submission as the defining aspect of sexuality was actually embodied in all sexual acts across these societies, and not just in the writing about all sexual acts, remains unknown. Our knowledge is limited, as it always is in history, by our sources. Because sexual acts were defined as the combination of dominance and submission, sexual acts between men could have, and generally did have, strongly political overtones. For example, the early Egyptian legend of the relations between the gods Horus and Seth demonstrate the political use of anal intercourse as a way of embarrassing a rival political power. As you may remember, I'm sure you have those Egyptian legends right at your fingertips. As you may remember, Horus was the son of the goddess Isis and her husband Osiris. And Osiris had been murdered by his brother Seth. So now Horus and Seth were contenders for supremacy among the gods. One of the episodes in the Egyptian myth relates the time when Seth invited Horus to his home for what appeared to be a conciliatory meal. However, the real purpose of the meal was to further Seth's royal aims by providing him with a situation in which he could anally rape Horus while he was sleeping after dinner. Seth's sexual dominance over Horus would prove to all the gods that Horus was unworthy to be supreme among them, and that Seth was a truly superior one. While this particular stratagem did not work out to Seth's advantage in this myth because of the fortuitous intervention of Isis to protect her son, the story does demonstrate what became a very common usage for male-male sexual intercourse in the ancient Mesopotamian world, particularly, that is, the demonstration of political dominance of one group over another. A similar view of male-male sexual acts can be found in the Assyrian dream omen series entitled Suma'alu, which includes 38 different omens that deal with various aspects of sexual acts. These dream omens, by the way, are quite similar to ones found much later in the writings of the very famous second century text by Artemidorus called The Interpretation of Dreams. If you're interested in dreams, it's a wonderful text to read. The point of these texts was to help you know your future by understanding the meaning of actions that occurred in your dreams. Now, among the omens that could appear in dreams that were listed in the Summa Aulu are the following four. If a man copulates with his equal from the rear, he becomes the leader among his peers and brothers. If a man copulates with a Asinu, which is a title for a special priest of the goddess Astarte, a hard destiny will leave him. If a man copulates with his male courtier or secretary, terrors will possess him for a whole year, but then they'll leave him. If a man copulates with a house-born slave, a hard destiny will befall him. From this list, it can be seen that having sex with someone of equal rank in one's dreams was a matter of good fortune, for it meant that one would be superior or dominant over those of equal rank. On the other hand, having sex with someone in one's dreams who is of much lower rank, like a secretary, or worst of all, a slave, is a bad omen, because it assumes only what society already allows to a free man. Now, what was desirable in one's dreams was, of course, not at all acceptable from the standpoint of real personal action. The same Assyrian culture that produced the Summa Aulu also produced the Middle Assyrian law codes, which had one section that said, quote, if a man has sex with his comrade and they prove the charges against him and find him guilty, they shall have sex with him and they shall turn him into a eunuch, end quote. In other words, in real life, sex between equals, at least for the one who perpetrated the act, is punishable by sexually abusing him and castrating him to keep him from ever repeating his offense. The one who received the act is, of course, already disgraced and dishonored. So while one might dream of achieving sexual dominance over one's equals, it was far better not to act out one's dreams, since such acts were judged as sexual and social and political violence. While we've been talking so far about ancient Mesopotamian culture, one can see the same political usage of male-male anal intercourse much later. There's a very famous picture from Greece that celebrates the victory of the Athenians over the Persians in 460 BCE. In the picture, a Greek soldier with erect penis in hand approaches from the rear a distressed, defeated Persian soldier who is bent over waiting to be penetrated by the Greek. The picture was intended to show, through the imagery of male-male sexual intercourse, that the Greeks now dominate the submissive Persians. This picture was not a form of ancient pornography. It was instead a powerful form of ancient politics. In myth, law, treaties, monuments, and pottery decorations, political and military domination was often conventionally symbolized by sexual domination between men. The Egyptian and Assyrian texts demonstrating the importance of male-male sexual acts in establishing political, cultural, or social dominance over another may provide us with a helpful context for understanding some of the possible homoerotic texts within the Hebrew Bible. For example, in the story of Sodom found in Genesis 19:1-11, the desire of all the men of Sodom to know the foreign visitors who are staying overnight in the house of that other foreigner, Lot, probably represents precisely the same scenario of political or social dominance. You may recall that the story depicts three angels coming to the city of Sodom and deciding to spend the night in the public square of the city. Lot, who is himself a foreigner living in the city of Sodom, begs the three visitors to stay inside within his house for the night, evidently fearing some untoward activity by the rest of the population. After much begging on Lot's part, the three visitors agree to stay with Lot and his family. During the night, all of the men of Sodom surround Lot's house and demand that he send his three male guests out that they might know them. The Hebrew verb yada, which simply means to know, is occasionally used, as in this instance, in the sexual sense in the Hebrew Bible. Lot is appalled at what the men of Sodom request, and instead of sending out his three male guests, he offers the men of Sodom the use of his two virginal daughters, that they might know them, which I guess seemed to him to be a good solution. What in the world is going on in this very disturbing story? If we put this story in the context of the political or social consequences of ancient sexual acts, what the men of Sodom intend in raping these foreign visitors is to show their social and cultural dominance over those foreigners who would come to their city, in much the same way that the picture of the Greek soldier approaching the Persian soldier celebrated Greek dominance over Persian culture. As an added value from the point of view of the men of Sodom to this act of cultural dominance over foreign travelers, by humiliating visitors of Lot's, who was himself a foreigner in the city of Sodom, the men of Sodom could also show their dominance over Lot and, in fact, bring disgrace upon his house. Honor in antiquity was a zero-sum game. That means that one could only gain honor if somebody else lost honor. If Lot lost honor, the men of Sodom would thereby gain it. If Lot loses no honor, the men of Sodom gain no honor. Lot's offer of his two virginal daughters to the men of Sodom was still a loss of honor to his house, but not nearly the disgrace that the humiliation of his three male guests would bring. Daughters, after all, are submissive women whose sexual use by men is natural. Like the Middle Assyrian dream omen, having sex with those who are naturally passive, women or slaves, brings little or no honor to the perpetrator. That the purpose of the men of Sodom in this story was to show their social and cultural dominance over foreigners is confirmed by the vast majority of references to the acts of Sodom in the rest of the Bible. In other biblical texts, in Ezekiel, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Zephaniah, where these are alluded to, Sodom's evils are listed as being pride, failure to help the poor, and a lack of hospitality to foreigners. Not sexual abuse. Indeed, the one reference in the biblical material to the so-called sin of Sodom that might carry some sexual overtone is found in the tiny New Testament book of Jude, verse 7. Jude has only verses, it has no chapters, it's too short. In that text, the author of Jude accuses the men of Sodom of seeking alien flesh. The Greek here is sarkos heteros, alien flesh. Other flesh, flesh, other flesh. Given the context in Jude, which in the preceding verse has alluded to the odd story of sexual relations between angels and the daughters of men in Genesis 6, 1 through 4, this reference to alien texts interprets the act of the men of Sodom as not seeking simple dominance over foreigners, but instead seeking dominance over angels. After all, the Genesis story does indicate that the three visitors were angels, although Lot and the men of Sodom do not seem to recognize that fact in the story itself. From Jude's perspective, however, the men of Sodom were actually attempting to declare themselves dominant over the divine, an act of incredible pride. It is possible that this same context of dominance and submission and the political and social ramifications of sexual acts between men should also inform our understanding of the prohibitions against male same-sex intercourse found in the book of Leviticus in the Hebrew Bible. Leviticus 18:22 and 20:13 both say categorically that a man shall not sleep with another man as with a wife. These two prohibitions fall within a body of legal material known as the Holiness Code. The Holiness Code itself was most likely written down in the post-exilic period. In other words, probably somewhere in the late 6th or early 5th centuries BCE. The post-exilic period was a time in which the Judites who returned to Jerusalem from exile in Babylon were attempting to reestablish their national and cultural identity. The Holiness Code participates in that reestablishment by setting up legal boundaries between the behavior and social structure of the new Jewish community in Jerusalem and that of its half-Jewish or non-Jewish neighbors. And by the way, there's a tremendous amount of controversy about whether the prohibitions in the Holiness Code were ever actually practiced by anybody all the way through the New Testament period. Many scholars think they were not. But they are not descriptive of the community, but prescriptive about what the community ought to be as an ideal. At any rate, the two prohibitions, one in chapter 18 and one in chapter 20, are quite similar. And they may be, as the biblical scholar Phyllis Bird has argued, an attempt to preserve the internal harmony of Jewish male society by prohibiting the use of anal intercourse as a form of expressing or winning social and political honor or dominance. Jewish males were not to dishonor other Jewish males by treating them like wives. The underside of this law, of course, is that wives were normally and naturally to be dishonored, or perhaps better said and less provocatively said, that passivity, which was dishonorable for a man, was assumed to be the natural condition of wives. Besides preserving social harmony within Jewish male society by denying the transfer of honor through the sexual game, the prohibitions against same-sex male intercourse in the Holiness Code also distinguished these Jews as a national group from what the Holiness Code asserted was the common behavior of their neighbors, the Canaanites, who, according to the Holiness Code, approved all such activities. Consequently, the rejection of intra-tribal same-sex male intercourse became another marker of the national and cultural boundary between the returned community of Judites and their neighbors. As with Egypt, Assyria, and other Mesopotamian countries, the later empires of Greece and Rome also defined proper sexual relations as occurring only between people whose status was unequal. However, both Greece and Rome developed the rules and roles of sexual activity in ways somewhat different from the early Mediterranean models. It is in classical Greece that homoerotic relations between men became not only acceptable, but indeed worthy and laudable. In Athens and in Sparta, the socialization of free young Greek men was accomplished through the complex rituals of what was called paiderasty, or the love of boys. The Greeks believed that the hard work of education and socialization needed for the creation of a strong democracy of free citizens required powerful motivation. If you think about that for a minute, learning is not easy. In fact, it can be downright boring a lot of the time. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. The Greeks believed that you had to have a strong motivation to keep doing it. Learning to be a civilized, socialized person is hard work. And for the Greeks, that motivation was to be found in the erotic. Now, in our society, with its sort of erotophobia, that is never going to be, at least publicly, the motivation for doing anything. So we've substituted money. You work hard so you can get a good job, so you can earn a lot of money, so you can go into debt, and so, whatever. Buy more stuff. Keep the economy rolling so you can spend more money, buy more stuff. And I don't know that money works as well as eroticism does, but we can discuss that at another time. At any rate, the Greeks believed that the hard work of education and socialization needed for the creation of a strong democracy of free citizens required a powerful motivation, and that motivation was found in the erotic. Young boys, following puberty at around 12 or 13, were encouraged to accept older Greek male citizens as their patrons and educators into the social and civic life of the city-state. These relationships between the older men and the post-pubescent boys was profoundly erotic in nature. the erastes, the Greek word, or older active male lover, courted his chosen beloved young boy, the eromenos, by bringing him gifts. There are a lot of pictures of this on Greek pottery and so forth. Bringing him gifts of dead animals, crops, or other similar masculine presents. Vying with other men to entice the favors of the finest young boys available in each generation. In terms of preserving or enhancing the civic standards of the polis, this romantic game between men was ideal. Greek men, generally in their younger years prior to marriage, competed with one another through athletic, civic, and political contests of honor to gain the notice and admiration of young Greek boys, who, at the same time, were being given superb models of the best forms of honorable civic participation. The whole ritual of paiderasty was profoundly interlaced with rules and family oversight to protect, particularly the boys, from abusive relationships. This pattern of boy-man erotic involvement was especially strongly encouraged in the military environment of Sparta. Indeed, the Spartans believed, unlike the U.S. military, that the most indestructible army would be the one composed completely of male lovers. Now, you think about this for a minute. They reasoned that a man's willingness to fight hard or even die for the sake of his lover who was standing right at his side in battle would be far greater than a man's willingness to fight or die for the more abstract principle of national pride.
Amen.
Thank you. So homoerotic relations between boys and young men were encouraged as a way of producing the most manly virtues of military prowess, courage, athletic ability, and political statesmanship. This educational and civilizing component of same-sex eroticism in the classical Greek city-states was of such value that same-sex relations were actually prohibited by law in Athens between free citizens and slaves. This is such an important thing, you can't do this with a slave. That was prohibited by law. And of course, same-sex relations between a free citizen and slaves were in fact the most common form of same-sex relations in most of the Mediterranean world. For most of the Greeks of the classical period, paiderasty was the key motivational factor in the education and socialization of the next generation of city leaders. While paiderastic relationships for many Greek men ended with their marriage in their late 20s or 30s, they were expected to continue their warm relationships with their former paiderastic lovers throughout their lives, providing a deeply homosocial and indeed homoerotic context for Greek society as a whole. While the Romans took on many of the cultural developments and religious beliefs of the Greek city-states they conquered, they were never particularly pleased with the Greek ideal of paiderastic relations. For the Romans, passivity or submission should never cloud the life of a free Roman man, even when that man was still a boy. There were, for example, a number of rumors, you can find this in several speeches from ancient biographies, there were a number of rumors about the early boyhood of Julius Caesar and his relations to certain royal families in other countries that persistently dogged Caesar's political career in the voice of his opponents. These rumored erotic proclivities of his youth towards submission in same-sex relations were suggested as indications of a character flaw that should undercut his potential as a ruler of Rome. Whatever the value of such rumors, the Romans, like the Greeks, were generally quite at ease with same-sex erotic relations when those relations involved people of unequal social status, that is, slaves or foreigners. But the Romans and the Greeks both found homoerotic relations appalling when they involved or seemed to involve people of equal social status, since one man in the sexual relation would have to play the submissive, penetrated role. Why anyone of dominant social status, basically a free male, would want to be submissive to another man was difficult, if not impossible, for either Greeks or Romans to understand. Such desire, that is, to be submissive or passive, was seen in a man as either illness or moral decay. Thus, for most Greek and Roman moralists, the primary ethical or moral problem posed by same-sex erotic acts between social equals concerned only explaining the personality or nature of the passive partner. The active dominant partner in same-sex erotic relations was simply performing the natural sexual role of a free man. To understand more fully the danger involved in same-sex erotic acts between equals for the Greeks and the Romans, it's important for us to spend a few moments thinking about the construction of gender roles in Mediterranean antiquity. The reason that the passive role in homoeroticism was disgraceful or shameful was, of course, because it was the role assumed to be natural for women. Women, slaves, children, and also foreigners were generally assumed by both Greeks and Romans to be by nature passive, not by education or circumstance, but by nature passive and submissive, in contrast to the natural activity and dominance of free males. Women in particular were constructed as passive, submissive beings within Greco-Roman antiquity. Now, whether individual women within the Greco-Roman world always behaved in passive or submissive ways is really not the point here. We know, in fact, that they did not. The point is that the cultural ideal dictated passivity. The submissive role was natural to women, it was argued, because of their creation as deficient men. In a fascinating study of gender construction in antiquity, Thomas LaCour has shown that ancient Mediterranean understandings of the body posited the view that both men and women shared the same physical structure. That is, there is only one body, but it comes in two forms, a perfect male form and an imperfect female one. All the organs and fluids that men had in their bodies, women also had. The difference was simply the placement of those organs. Men's genital organs were exterior, while the exact same genital organs in women were interior. As the famous second century physician Galen of Pergamon said, "Turn outward the woman's, turn inward, so to speak, and full double, the man's genital organs, and you will find the same in both in every respect." This one body, shared by both men and women, was only differentiated by the outward appearance of the genitalia, the assumed heat or coolness of the body itself, and, of course, by rigidly enforced gender roles. Because ancient men shared with ancient women the same body, the line between male and female, the physical line between male and female, was an especially fragile and anxiety-producing one, particularly for men who held the higher level. It is true that women as defective males were assumed to be cooler, so that in fact the seed planted in them would not burn up, but come to fruition. While men were hotter, thereby producing the spiritual concoction of fluids needed to transform the physical matter women provided in reproduction into a spiritual and physical being. Now, you couldn't actually put your hand on somebody and feel that they were cooler or hotter, but the Greeks would have thought that was a silly thing to try. But they were cooler and hotter. They just were. And Galen, by the way, says in a couple of places that he knows of men who had babies, because men have all the equipment to have babies. But the only reason they generally don't is because they're too hot. And so the seed in them just burns up, doesn't do anything. This difference in temperature, but, now here's the catch here, this difference in temperature could easily be undone should men spend too much time in the company of women. Effeminate men were often assumed to like women too much, cooling their hard manly virtues into female softness. Alternatively, as Galen also remarked on a number of occasions, if a woman became too hot, as, for example, in running across a field, Her genitals might suddenly pop out and she would become a man. He has several examples in his works of this happening. Since the physical... Now pay attention to this. If you learn anatomy, you have to learn it in seminary. Since the physical anatomical separation between the perfect dominant male and the imperfect submissive female was so strikingly tenuous, social differentiation needed to be strongly defended and heavily marked. Much of the disdain ancient Mediterranean moralists felt for same-sex erotic relations came less from the sexual acts themselves than from the gender role reversals they required. Male same-sex relations required one man to be passive and submissive, in other words, to take on the gender role of a woman. Female same-sex relations, which are relatively rarely discussed by ancient writers, but they are discussed occasionally, are often classed as a type of monstrosity, since one female, it was assumed, would have to be acting as the dominant penetrator. Such a woman was a physical and moral monster, someone completely out of control. Consequently, homoerotic relations among any who might even vaguely be considered social equals was an essential way of policing the crucial boundaries between the genders in antiquity. We can find in Paul's letters in the Greek New Testament several places where he seems very concerned to preserve gender role boundaries within the Christian communities to whom he is writing. Perhaps the most famous of these texts can be found in the first letter of the Corinthians, to the Corinthians, chapter 11, verses 2 through 16. In this section of 1 Corinthians, Paul attempts to make a very, let's admit it, convoluted argument for why women should cover their heads when they are praying or speaking in public assembly. He argues that the order of creation, with God as its head, Christ under God, the man under Christ, and the woman under the man, witnesses to this requirement. If, Paul says, a man prays with his head covered, he dishonors his head, which is Christ. But if a woman prays with her head uncovered, she dishonors her head, which is man. Nature itself, Paul goes on to say, shows that men's hair should be short and not long, and that women's hair should be long and not short. If that argument seems a bit illogical to you, you're in good company. Not only generations of commentators, but probably the Corinthians themselves had difficulty trying to figure out what Paul was saying. However awkwardly phrased, what Paul intended to do in this passage was to underscore the importance of following the cultural dress codes that proper gender role performance required. Paul is trying to convince the Corinthian community to conform in their ecstatic worship services to the same set of gender role markers that the society in general enforced. This passage is particularly famous because it's so obscure and so very obviously culturally bound. As Paul attempts shows, it is hard to come up with logical arguments for the often arbitrary social conventions demanded by gender role boundaries. These same concerns for gender role propriety may well lie behind the one clear reference in the Greek New Testament to homoerotic behavior, also found in one of Paul's letters, Romans 1, 26 and 27. In the first chapter of Romans, Paul describes those people who reject the true God in favor of idols. Even though this group, Paul argues, did not have the benefit of the Torah or law that was given to the Jews, nevertheless, they had the benefit of the natural world, in which they could, had they wished to, perceive the good works of the one God. Instead of worshiping the true God, Paul asserts, these people chose to worship, quote, images resembling mortal man or birds or reptiles or animals. Because of this disobedience, Paul affirms, the true God gave these people up to their own passions, to to their own shamefulness. It is at this point that Paul gives us verses 26 and 27. Let me quote them. Quote, "For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural use for those beyond nature, and their men likewise gave up natural use of women and were consumed with passion for one another. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error." End quote. In Paul's version of homoeroticism, it has become a punishment by God for idolatry. Because these people rejected the worship of the true God and turned to idols instead, God abandoned them to their own passions, now run wild and out of control. In this disordered state, these people exchanged natural roles for ones that were, in the Greek, paraphysin, that is, beyond nature, inordinate desires. Paul's argument appears to be that because these idolaters do not recognize the true God as their head, they also do not honor the natural order of gender role behaviors, in which man is always dominant and woman always submissive. They exchange that natural order for sexual relations in which their women become the sexual aggressors. And by the way, you ought to know here that many of the early church fathers who commented on this verse, verse 26 in Romans, took Paul to mean that these women were dominating their male partners, not that they were having sex with other women. And the men desired both to penetrate other men and be penetrated by them. Some Greco-Roman moralists assumed that men who participated often in homoerotic acts became impotent as a result. And that view may be what Paul is referring to by the statement, receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. Or it may be, as other moralists assume, the loss of virility and honor associated with rejecting male gender role performance were the penalties Paul had in mind. Such disordered behavior, which blurred the vital boundaries between men and women, was totally repugnant to Paul, who, to be honest, was not a fan of sexual expression or desire at any time, even in its most natural setting between a husband and a wife. For Paul, you know, it would be better if you could be like him, whatever that meant. Sexual passion itself was always a dangerous commodity. And this is actually true in a lot of antiquity, but certainly in Paul's view. Sexual passion itself was always a dangerous commodity because it could easily get out of control. And for Paul, it always had the potential to distract the followers of Jesus from their proper spiritual vocation. Would that they could all be as he was, a man whose self-mastery of desire was absolute. The connection between idolatry and homoeroticism is an important one for Paul. Since idolatry is the actual cause of homoeroticism, same-sex erotic acts were simply not encountered among those who worshipped the true God. Like his Jewish contemporary Philo of Alexandria, Paul evidently believed that Jews did not participate in homoerotic behavior. Only foreigners or Gentiles did. Since even the Gentile converts to Christianity now worship the true God through their faith in Jesus Christ, they too were freed from any danger of participating in homoerotic or gender-reversing behavior. This assumption of a necessary connection between idol worship and homoeroticism may be the reason it is so rarely mentioned in Paul's letters, and never mentioned at all elsewhere in the New Testament. So much more could be said about the construction of gender roles and sexuality in Mediterranean antiquity. But even the little that I have tried to review with you this morning places the few biblical texts that deal with homoeroticism in a quite different light, I think, from what most modern debates about the Bible and homosexuality seem to assume. The biblical writers knew nothing of sexual orientation, mutual erotic relationships, or sexuality as the expression of a passion for equality and intimacy. Our world is not their world, and theirs is not ours. And as a woman, I guess I have to say thank goodness to that. I believe that the Bible is a marvelous book. It is for Christians a constant witness to the reality of God's incarnation, God's coming in the flesh. And it witnesses to that event not only through what it says, but through what it is. The Bible itself is an incarnated word, a word in the flesh, blood, and bones of the societies and cultures in which it was written. It should, I think, always remind us that we are all limited by our historical moment, or as Paul said, that we all see through a glass darkly. We must always evaluate the cultural values in the Bible to determine if they are indeed God's will for our present. This isn't a new issue. We've had to deal with this issue over the question of war. We've had to deal with this issue over the question of slavery. We've had to deal with this over the question of polygamy, over the question of the status of women. There are many ways in which we've had to deal with this same issue, the incarnated nature of the Bible itself. The natural submission of women and the natural domination of men are not the values many of us would like to see America emulate. Yet it is precisely those values that lie behind the very little the Bible does say about homoeroticism. In a very real way, I think, to stand with the Bible in its rejection of same-sex erotic acts is also to stand with the Bible in its adherence to misogyny. And hatred of women is not a cultural value I will ever claim should be normative for contemporary culture, especially contemporary Christian culture. Thank you very much.